barely clinging to consciousness with the aid of deadly stim overdoses. Buddy recovered at a rapid rate after injecting himself with a serum derived from Atara's blood. He'd convulsed in pain at first, giving her a few minutes of worry and despair, but then the pain subsided and she could tell in a few minutes something was happening. His fever broke almost at once, and the black lesions on his skin, another sign of the terrible disease, began to dry out and fall off within just a couple hours. By evening, maybe 6 hours after he injected himself, he seemed almost normal. Indeed, his only symptoms remaining were those caused by the stims. By morning, a series of blood tests had confirmed the virus was gone. Atara didn't know whether the problem applied to blood from everyone on Planet Zero, or the Masters and Survivors on other worlds of the Coreward region, but there wasn't time for proper analysis, and Weldon's near-fatal reaction to the first reckless experiment hardly recommended more trial and error. As far as she knew, right now, she was the only source of the immunity factor that could save the landing party. And there were a lot of them still sick, every one of them dying. Weldon was trying to refine his formula, to stretch out the blood she could supply, and he was pumping her full of retinol and every other drug he could think of to spur increased blood production in her body. "I think I can get 40 doses from the blood you were able to provide. That doesn't get us through this nightmare, but giving it to the 40 most dire cases will give us a little more time." Weldon paused. "That is, of course, assuming the worst ones aren't too far gone, even for the serum."
"Then let's not waste time. Go. The sickest ones are in cryostasis. That's going to complicate things a little, isn't it?"
"It'll slow them down. I just don't have enough ambulatory staff to handle the med pods." She leaned forward yet again, struggling to get to her feet. "Atara, you're too weak to stand up, and certainly to help me by playing medtech with the pods.
Give me one of those stims you are taking."
"No, you're too weak."
"Weaker than you were?"
She angled her head and stared at him, a wordless message that he shouldn't even bother to try to tell her she was.
"No, perhaps not, but no buts. You know it's the only option. We've got, what, 2 dozen of the landing parties still on their feet? And every one of them is sick too, except you and me. So let's get the shit and give me one of those injections, and then we can go save our people."
She glared across the room, watching as he finally just nodded and turned to pick up the injector. She took a deep breath as he crossed the room to give her the shot. She knew she was right. There was no choice, none save watching her people die. And to Atara Travis, that was no option at all, not when there was any hope of saving them. And Brian Rogan was at the top of that list. The big Marine had somehow endured, refusing to give up his fragile hold on life, even as men and women infected far later than Rogan had died every day. Rogan was one of Atara's true friends, and the idea of her blood providing a cure too late to save him was more than she wanted to imagine.
"Hang on, Brian. We're coming."
Stockton's fighters zipped through space, heading back toward the designated assembly area of the fleet's combined squadrons. He could see clouds of small craft converging as his fighter barreled toward the rendezvous point. The wings were far more densely concentrated than he'd ever seen in a major battle, but he was betting everything on the enemy's lack of their own squadrons, and he wanted his force focused, ready to hit the hegemony ships hard. Stockton had hoped the enemy wouldn't have any vessels bigger than those the fleet had already met and destroyed, but his scanning mission to Z-12 had dashed those thoughts. He picked up numerous large contacts, even bigger than the new Dauntless, and those could only be battleships. The smaller vessels his people had faced had been tough enough. He knew it would take all his squadrons had to hurt the behemoths he knew were coming. His eyes dropped to the screen displaying the data streaming in from the transit point drones. There were enhanced energy levels, but nothing else. No transits after his, no vessels coming through. And then one appeared. It was large, one of the big ones he'd presumed to be a battleship. It was half again as long as Dauntless, and his best guess was it outmassed the fleet's flagship by at least 2 million tons, probably 3 million. He was surprised. He'd expected something smaller, a scout ship or frigate equivalent. But the hegemony seemed to show no signs of caution. He wondered if they could be that certain of their invincible superiority, and then he thought about the aspect of the question that really scared him. Were they really that good? More ships began to come through, one after the other. He analyzed their velocities and vectors, and he let out a breath of relief. The enemy ships were on exactly the course he'd projected. He tapped his throttle and decelerated, beginning to bring his ship around to form up with his wings.
He didn't have a single weapon aboard, but he'd be damned if he was going to run back to Dauntless and land while his people were about to go in. Lasers or no lasers, Jake Raptor Stockton was going to lead the attack. There were almost 24 ships through already, including 5 of the big ones, and Stockton reached out and tapped at his controls, overlaying the minefield on his scanner. The lead enemy ships were just entering the area, and he waited, noting that he hadn't sent out any signals yet to detonate the mines.
Is it possible it's that simple? They've never faced mines before, so they don't have the countermeasures every Rim Nation does.
He wished the fleet had carried more of the ordnance, that they hadn't been limited to the small number of makeshift mines Fritz and her crew had been able to throw together. But anything was better than nothing, and his eyes were fixed on the display, as the first of the enemy ships encountered one of the deadly weapons. The ship didn't actually strike the mine. The percentage chance of something like that was vanishingly small with the distances involved in interplanetary navigation and combat. But the massive nuclear warhead detonated less than 3/4 of a kilometer from the Hegemony battleship. The great vessel staggered, hit by massive waves of intensely hard radiation. In some areas, the alloy of the ship's hull buckled and melted as intense energy poured over the vessel. Gashes appeared in the armor, and great geysers of air and fluids blasted out into space, freezing almost instantly into long pillars that floated out from the stricken vessel like massive spears thrown into the void. Stockton felt a smile forming on his lips as he saw the damage. He'd enjoyed 2 years of peace, but he'd always known that he was a creature of war. He craved peace, but he needed an enemy. Now he had one, and from all he'd seen about them, they were even more detestable than the Union. The predator in him was alive again, in control, awakened from 2 years of hibernation. His grin widened as a second mine exploded, triggered by one of the smaller enemy ships. The vessel was a bit farther away and the damage less severe, but every bit helped. He sat in the cockpit, all thoughts of his discomfort and soreness gone now, and he watched as nearly 24 mines detonated over the next few minutes. Ship after ship was impacted, at least 2 of them suffering what appeared to be serious damage. He tried to imagine the arrogant masters, so utterly convinced of their superiority, communicating frantically as their ships triggered one nuclear detonation after another. He could pick up the signals back and forth between the ships, but the encryption had defied all attempts at decoding, at least so far. He watched as the approaching force passed through the last of the mined area and moved toward his waiting squadrons. His eyes narrowed, focused on the screen as the enemy's leading ships continued forward. He was watching for any evasive maneuvers, any course changes he'd have to match, but the wall of ships just kept coming forward. He waited as another minute passed by, then 90 seconds. The enemy was coming just as he projected. It was time. He flipped on his comm line, setting the channel to the entire strike force.
Attention all units, this is Raptor.
He might have used his name and rank, but there wasn't a pilot in the force, or in the entire Confederation, who didn't know who Raptor was.
Here they come. These people don't seem to know what fighters can do, so we're gonna give them a lesson now, one they'll never forget.
He reached out, putting his hand on his ship's throttle. He didn't have a gun hot enough to cook his lunch, but he was going in with his people anyway.
Squadron leaders, you all know your positions. Bombers, this is your show. With any luck, you'll get the chance to hit these ships without worrying about interceptors, so take your time and focus. I want those torpedoes planted right into the guts of these ships. You've all seen what their heavy guns can do to our capital ships, so keep that in mind when you're launching. Your comrades on the motherships need you to hit this force hard before they can get into range and rake our battleships.
Stockton tightened his grip on the throttle.
You're all veterans. You know what to do.
That wasn't technically true. He had a few rookies in the strike force, but the vast majority of his people had seen action against the Union. He took a deep breath and glanced down at his screen again. The enemy fleet was large, powerful, and he knew just how deadly those ships were. He was confident his wings would savage the Hegemony forces, but he didn't know if it would be enough. His squadrons would have the advantage now, but once they'd completed their runs, the surviving enemy ships would close and rake the fleet with deadly beams, long before Dauntless and the other battleships were able to return fire. He didn't know exactly how much damage his people had to cause to even things out, at least beyond the disturbingly non-specific, a lot. He inhaled again, holding the breath for a few seconds before exhaling hard. Then he nodded, a gesture to himself, and he tapped the comm again.
Let's go, he said, his voice cold, grim.
All squadrons, attack.
Chapter 39. 200,000 kilometers from transit point Alpha. Z-11 system. Year 315 AC. Stockton brought his fighter around, angling toward the massive battleship 60,000 kilometers directly ahead of him. At least he assumed anything bigger than the huge new Dauntless had to be a battleship, though for all he really knew, the enemy considered the ship a frigate, and somewhere they had vessels 3 or 4 times the size. That wasn't something he wanted to dwell on, not while his people were coming in against the largest, most powerful ship they'd ever faced. The Imperial Planet Killer had been larger, but that had been inoperative, and Stockton had no doubt that the vessel in front of him was completely ready for action. He had 2 bomber squadrons coming in against the vessel, approaching along distinct vectors. He planned out every detail of the attack, and it allowed for any possibility. Simultaneous squadron assaults were difficult to execute and were intended mostly to overwhelm a target's point defense capability. The hegemony vessel seemed to lack the dedicated anti-fighter batteries that Confederation vessels and all other warships of the Rim Nations mounted. But he'd seen the escort ships in the previous fight repurpose their smaller guns to close-in defense, and he'd watched them make it work after a fashion, adapting, steadily increasing their kill rate. He wasn't going to let his guard down, not for an instant. The squadron leaders acknowledged their bombers were in position.
Yellow Lightning Squadron ready for attack run. Gold Vipers ready.
Stockton took one last look at the scanner. Then he said simply, "You may begin your attacks, Lightnings, Vipers." He brought his own ship around, adjusting his vector to match those of the Gold Vipers. It wasn't an intentional preference. The Vipers were the closest to his position, and he intended to go in with the attack one way or another. Dauntless's pilots, including the legendary Blue Squadron, were on the far side of the formation. His instinct had been to fly over there, to join up with his old command. But he knew they didn't need him. He'd forged the Blues into a deadly weapon, as he had all of Dauntless's wings. It hurt to think they didn't need him anymore, but he knew it was true. He could do more with less experienced squadrons like the Vipers and the Lightnings. He positioned himself in the middle of the attacking squadron and tapped the throttle, matching his velocity with that of the bombers. He looked down at his screen. He had nothing of his own to throw against the enemy ship, but he could watch, study, analyze. He'd seen the enemy learning in the last battle, watched them figure out almost immediately how to counter his fighters. Now he would watch, and learn exactly what the hegemony ships could do. Then he could figure out how to counter it, how to best destroy the enemy. The target ship was just ahead, and even as he rechecked the range, his scanners flashed to life. The enemy was firing its weapons. For an instant, Stockton thought they might be using point defense batteries, but the pulses were too heavy, the firing angles too imprecise. The enemy was doing the same thing the earlier ships had, repurposing its smaller batteries, but the battleship had a lot more guns than the cruisers or escorts had.
"Evasive maneuvers going in. I don't want anyone getting careless. Those guns aren't optimized for anti-fighter operations, but a hit will kill you just as dead as a point defense laser."
Stockton's hand moved to the side, following his own orders. Blundering into a clumsily targeted laser blast wasn't the example he wanted to set for his pilots.
"And don't forget, these ships are faster and more maneuverable than our own."
He didn't know that for certain about the battleships, but he'd seen the thrust levels the cruisers had employed, and it seemed a reasonable assumption that the big capital ships were also faster than their Confederation counterparts.
"So we're going in, all the way in. I don't want a torpedo launched outside 10,000 kilometers, and 6,000 would be better."
His eyes moved to the screen, watching the wave of bombers as they made their final approaches. The Vipers and Lightnings were coming in from different angles, one approaching the hegemony ship's starboard side and the other the port. He watched as the ships formed up into 3 lines, a third of the vessels accelerating slightly and a third decelerating. Each squadron was coming in on a narrow angle, heading right for the massive ship's midsection. Stockton glanced at the range display. 15,000 kilometers. Very close by normal standards, but not for this fight. He'd already promised every pilot in the strike force that he'd skin them alive if they launched a torpedo from 15,000. The bombers moved in closer, and as they did, they began to take losses. One of the Vipers was hit first, followed by 2 of the Lightnings. The effectiveness of the enemy targeting was improving with each passing moment.
"How could they analyze our approach and capabilities so quickly?"
"I said evasive maneuvers,"
he roared into the comm as he watched the second Lightning ship hit.
The first two fighters had been destroyed, but the last one took a glancing blow, and it spiraled out of the attack formation. Stockton didn't know if the pilot would regain control and manage to limp back to the mothership in his damaged fighter, or if he would have to ditch. But his gut told him the survival chances of any pilots who ejected in this battle were damned poor. The fire from the target ship increased in frequency. At first, Stockton was concerned the ship had more batteries than he'd expected, but then he realized the rate of fire had increased. It was just another jarring example of the enemy's technological advantage, most likely superior energy generation and transmission, something that had confounded Confederation engineers for two generations. His eyes remained fixed as the first line of bombers slipped in under 10,000 kilometers. The Lightnings were about 2 seconds ahead of the Vipers, but the two squadrons had come very close to executing the synchronous assaults he'd ordered. The limited fire from the target ship was indeed split between the two squadrons. Stockton was grateful for that, especially as he saw another of the Vipers hit, a bird no more than 4,000 kilometers from his position, practically on top of him by the standards of space combat. He checked his scanners, looking for a pod, any clue to suggest the pilot had escaped, but there was nothing. The fire was heavier now, and the destruction of a ship so close by jarred him against being careless. His modified Lightning handled in a way he'd charitably describe as like a pig, and he focused again on making himself a difficult target. He had no real reason to be where he was, save for the fact that he couldn't bring himself to watch more than 700 fighters under his command attack while he held back. He suspected Admiral Barron would give him a tongue-lashing over when he returned to Dauntless. His lead ships were under 7,000 kilometers and moving at almost 500 kilometers per second. Against a vessel with a proper point defense array, he knew the squadrons would have been virtually wiped out by now. But his force, despite the losses it had suffered, was largely intact. He felt a wave of pride in his people, in the determination with which they were following his orders. All their training told them to launch their torpedoes from ranges vastly farther out, but they understood that the realities of combat had changed with the discovery of the hegemony. The enemy ships were too maneuverable. Not a single torpedo would hit from 20 or 30,000 kilometers. He watched as the first line of bombers let their torpedoes fly, the small devices accelerating at 50G for a few seconds, blasting hard toward the target. Then, almost simultaneously, the doomsday eyes directing each of them triggered the reactions that converted their entire mass to energy, transforming each projectile into a super-hot plasma heading right for the enemy vessel. The ship fired its engines, a last-ditch evasive maneuver to escape from the path of the deadly projectiles. The plasmas had consumed the mechanical drones that had carried them, and now they were fixed on a direct, unchangeable path. That gave the target a chance to evade, and the hegemony ship made the best of it, blasting its own engines at nearly 50G, lunging forward as a cluster of plasmas zipped by behind it, right through the space it had occupied seconds before. But it couldn't escape all the weapons. Stockton watched as the first plasma struck the battleship. The hit was in a secondary area. At least he knew it would have been secondary on a Confederation ship, and it failed to penetrate deeply into the ship. But the second and third hits, and then the fourth, smashed directly into the hull amidships. Stockton checked the readings. As best he could tell, the first hit had barely penetrated the great ship's heavy armor, but the next two ripped right through, and a few seconds later he could see the plumes on his scanner, internal explosions blasting back out through the hull. He had no idea how the ships were organized, where the reactors or other vital systems were located, but Raptor Stockton knew a bad hit when he saw one. The enemy's thrust dropped almost immediately, and two more plasmas, shots that would have missed had the thrust not dipped, smacked into the rear of the ship just above the engines. Stockton was excited as he saw the two impacts, and then again as his reading showed thrust dropping to... He watched, waited, and the numbers on his screen dipped to zero. They had knocked out the ship's engines. "Good shooting, Lightnings, Vipers. Damn good shooting. Now get back to base and refuel and rearm. There's a lot of fighting left to do." He brought his ship around, making a pass close by the enemy ship. It was dangerous, stupid he suspected Star would call it, but he wanted better scanning data. And as he zipped by, he saw that the batteries that had fired at his people were all silent now. He didn't know how badly the ship was really hurt, but he knew enough to put a big, evil smile on his face. A predator's grin. Atara looked down at Brian Rogan. The Marine was weak, pale, but she'd never seen him looking better. 12 hours before, the big man had barely been alive, hanging on by a thread in cryostasis. Now he was out of the med pod, lying on a cot in one of the portable shelters Doc Weldon had turned into a makeshift hospital. It was a strange feeling to know that Rogan was alive because of her blood. It was nothing she'd done, of course, no act of heroism in battle that had saved so many of her comrades, but she still felt good about it. All except for the fact that she hadn't been able to give enough blood to save them all. She was leaning forward, one hand gripping the cane Weldon had fashioned for her, and the other on the wall behind Rogan's bed. She was shaky. Weldon had argued with her for some time before he'd agreed to let her get up and walk around the camp at all, but she could feel her strength coming back. Slowly. "You saved his life, Atara." Weldon walked through the door and into the open area of the room. He waved his arm around the space, gesturing to the dozen other cots. Each of them held a member of the landing party who, hours before, had been at death's door. "You saved all of them."
"We saved them."
She'd take credit for supplying the blood, but it was Weldon's brilliance and tireless work that was primarily responsible for the serum. Dallas, the surgeon, even sick, exhausted, and strung out on stims, had beaten every medical team in the fleet to find a cure for the ancient plague. She sighed softly and frowned.
"We saved some of them."
The good feeling slipped away, even as she turned her head up from the sleeping Rogan and looked over at Weldon. They'd saved the sickest 40, but the others were in only slightly better shape, and they were deteriorating fast. She'd give more blood as soon as she could, but she knew it was going to be too late.
"Stu."
Weldon looked over at her. From the expression on his face, she could tell he knew what she was thinking. "We'll do all we can, Atara. We've freed up more med pods, and with cryostasis I can..."
"That's not good enough, Stu. You've got to take more blood now. Enough for at least another round of the serum."
"No, Atara, that's not possible. The risk to you is
more than it's been in battle."
"Atara, please."
"No, I'm serious, Stu. What about blood substitutes? You need the DNA in my blood, but I just need to have something pumping through my veins."
"It's not that simple. The substitute works for transfusions in limited quantities, but it can't replace all of your blood. I've already taken nearly twice the amount considered safe. I don't dare take any more, not for at least a few days."
"And how many of our people will die over those couple days? Comrade, your serum can save."
"I'll keep as many alive as I can, Atara."
"That's not an answer."
She paused. "I'm willing to take some risks, Stu. We have to do more. We have to try something." She looked right at him.
"Whatever that entails."
Weldon hesitated, looking uncomfortable.
"That's an order, Stu."
He remained silent for a moment. Finally, he said, "There's one thing, Atara, but it is dangerous. Very dangerous.
Let's do it, now."
"Atara, now, Stu." She leaned onto the cane and stepped slowly toward the doctor, something less than steady on her feet. "I can put you in a med pod and have the system take over as much of your bodily functions as possible. I can draw more blood, most of what's still there, and have the pod inject you with some drug treatments, something a little stronger than what I've been giving you already to spur blood production." He paused and looked at her, the uncertainty clear in his expression. "It will be very rough on your system, Atara. You could suffer permanent damage." Another pause. "You could die."
"Things have been trying to kill me for the last 7 years, Stu, and I haven't run from a fight yet. I'm not about to start now. Let's get started."
Weldon stood still, looking for a time as though he might continue arguing, but then he just nodded and said, "All right, Atara. If you insist on doing this, we have to get you into a pod. I have to put you in an induced coma." A pause. "Are you sure about this?"
"I'm sure."
Her voice was firm. At least it felt that way. But inside she was scared, in a way she'd never been against an external enemy. She trusted Weldon as much as she did anyone, but allowing herself to become helpless went against every instinct she had. She'd come from a place where helplessness was a virtual death sentence. But there was no choice. She wouldn't stand by and watch her people die. She couldn't. And her blood was the only way to save them. Chapter 40. PUV Carcaju. Approaching Baru. Rian System. Union Year 219. 315 AC. Denisov sat quietly, looking out at his bridge crew as Carcaju approached Baru. They were edgy.
It wasn't surprising, and he couldn't deny that he felt it, too. The last time his fleet had approached the rebel planet, they'd taken one hell of a beating, and they'd pulled back just in time to avoid a catastrophe. Going back, heading into those deadly guns that had blasted his ship so savagely, seemed like the sheerest folly. Only his ships weren't going back all the way. At least not right away. He had another way to fight the rebels in their orbital defenses, one he'd worked his crews to the bone to create. One he'd pulled from the system's asteroid belt and brought to Beru to unleash immense destruction. He'd picked out several dozen asteroids, small enough that his engineers had been able to create makeshift drives on each of them. It was rough, and he suspected most of those who'd worked on the project doubted that it would work. He even doubted it at times. But there was no way another frontal assault could succeed, not even with the damage his forces had done to the orbital defenses in the earlier fight. That left two options. His plan, as crazy as it seemed, or going back to Mont Morel and telling Gaston Villeneuve that Beru was still in the hands of rebels and traitors. Denisov could see the asteroids moving. Their velocities were low, at least by the normal standards of space travel. They were powered by really nothing more than a series of nuclear bombs situated to create the needed vectors toward Beru's orbital fortresses. But the asteroid belt was quite close to the planet, and the speeds of the massive chunks of rock were more than adequate to turn them into devastating kinetic energy weapons. He knew the targeting would be difficult. The warheads he'd placed to direct the asteroids as they approached Beru were hardly precision thrusters. Still, he was confident that at least some of the projectiles would hit their targets. The vast amount of dust and smaller chunks of rock released by collisions and nuclear explosions would wreak havoc on the laser buoys, blocking much of their fire as his warships moved up behind the asteroids and finished off whatever was left. There would be collateral damage, most likely an enormous amount. Many of the asteroids would continue past the high-level orbit of the defenses and enter the planet's atmosphere. That would represent a disaster of almost unimaginable proportions, an extinction-level event for Beru. Denisov didn't relish the idea of killing millions, of throwing a civilized, industrialized world back into the Stone Age. But he knew enough about what was happening in the unit to realize he didn't have a choice. Not if he wanted to survive. Denisov wasn't a politician, and he had no wish to be one. But he was sure of one thing. Villeneuve didn't give a shit about Beru's people, nor even its industrial production. He cared about having active rebels defying the Union's authority and setting an example for others to do the same. A cataclysmic end to Beru's pretensions at independence might even serve Villeneuve's needs more effectively than a conventional assault and the planet's quiet return into the fold. The lead wave is approaching planetary orbit, Admiral. Denisov turned toward the officer, but he didn't respond. He just nodded. He was doing what he had to do, but he wondered how many officers in history had caused the sort of devastation he was about to unleash on Beru. He felt as though he should be issuing frantic orders, but everything had already been planned, and all the pieces were in place. His fleet was right behind the asteroids, ready to hit the remaining fortresses during the moment of peak disruption. Carcaju's weapons were prepped as they were on every ship in the fleet. His people were nervous about hitting those defenses again, but he suspected most of them also craved revenge for the losses the fleet had suffered, for their comrades who had died. That was good. It would serve his purposes now. He could see the enemy fortresses firing, and he smiled. Good luck blasting those asteroids. The guns on the orbital platforms were powerful, and they outranged anything the ships of his fleet mounted, but they didn't have a chance of affecting anything with the mass and momentum of the great chunks of rock moving toward them. The hits blasted off small chunks, but that only aided the attackers, creating clouds of dust that degraded the laser fire from the buoys. He wondered if the rebels who'd taken control of the forts realized they were helping his plan. But then that was the beauty of the whole thing. What else could they do? They couldn't just let the asteroids come toward them unopposed, toward the planet below and its helpless billions. Denisov had never expected to commit genocide, and he was still fighting to justify what he was doing. He doubted Gaston Villeneuve would have the same reservations, but it had taken all of Denisov's discipline, and his self-delusion too, to fend off the urge to stop the attack. Now at least his self-control was superfluous. There was no way to divert the asteroids, not anymore. It was far too late. Not a single station had been hit yet, nor had a rock the size of his fist entered the atmosphere. But there was a cold inevitability to it all now. Beru's rebels could surrender, throw down their weapons, and beg for mercy. But it would all be to no avail. Their fates were sealed. Denisov stared straight ahead, watching, waiting, and trying to hold back the humanity that threatened to consume him.
I have wrought this. I have destroyed a world.
What the hell is going on? Remy Caron stood in his makeshift control center, trying to make sense of the reports coming in.
I don't know, First Protector. The orbital scans confirm the enemy ships have returned, but...
But what?
There are other contacts. The orbital stations report meteors, asteroids, a dozen of them, no more. Several dozen, all heading toward Baru.
That's impossible, Caron shouted. Caron was angry, but as Hoover stood and watched Baru's dictator pacing around the command center, shouting out pointless and repetitive commands, he realized that the man was just plain scared. He found Remy's behavior loathsome. After all the brutality he'd inflicted, the thousands, no, probably millions who died under his short rule, the man had no courage. Hoover had seen only Remy Caron, the merciless strongman of a communist revolution, but he'd heard stories of another man, a lowly factory worker, one who'd been reluctant to even join the uprisings against Union rule. His years with Confederation intelligence had shown him many things, and it had stripped him of any doubt on the level of depravity to which human beings could sink. He suspected Caron had risen initially by circumstance, and then found himself in a position of power that overwhelmed him. After a lifetime of helpless obedience to his Union masters, he just plain liked the taste of power, and he craved more, longed to safeguard what he'd gained, whatever the cost. That was all conjecture, but Hoover would have bet a small fortune he was close to the mark. Hoover had seen such things elsewhere, though Caron seemed to have become so corrupted very quickly. He hated working to support the dictator and his regime as much as Breen did, but he was in charge, and he understood that the Confederation's interests outweighed his, or his second's, personal feelings. Still, he felt anger watching Caron storm around the control center, and he was sorry he hadn't been able to side with the resistance. He felt a touch of sadness, too. He'd endowed Remy Caron could have been a tremendous leader for his people, that he could have brought them freedom, prosperity. But instead, he'd become what he had fought against, and his principles were sacrificed to the lust for power, the cravings for the luxury the defeated Union leaders had left behind. Hoover wished he could accomplish his mission by supporting the resistance, but Caron was the one in charge, and the Confederation wanted Baru to hold out as long as possible. If only. His thought was interrupted by a loud sound coming from out in the street. It was an explosion, he realized, as the muffled sounds of gunfire erupted outside the building. Caron spun around, gesturing toward his guards standing against the wall.
Go find out what's going on out there.
Hoover stood still, his training taking charge. His expression was impassive, the perfect poker face as he evaluated the situation. His first thought was that Union forces had somehow gotten through, but he quickly realized that was impossible. He was at a loss for a moment, and then it came to him, a few seconds before Amy Delacorte raced into the room, a column of her armed troopers right behind her.
It's Bernald and his rabble, she said,
gesturing toward the room, directing the soldiers to various positions around the room.
They're attacking the command post.
She moved toward the far doorway and looked into the hallway beyond.
You three,
she shouted down the corridor.
Get in position and cover that door.
She looked back toward Caron.
The filthy traitors, hitting us when we're trying to defend the planet. But don't worry, we'll make this an opportunity to wipe them out, every last one of them.
Hoover was surprised at first, but then it all started to make sense. He'd underestimated Bernard, but now his respect for the rebel grew. The resistance didn't have the strength to take on Caron and Delacorte's forces planet-wide, or even in the capital. But a decapitation strike. Delacorte's reassuring words to Caron, he suspected the resistance fighters outside had a good chance. A damned good chance. He turned and glanced back toward Breen, and instantly he knew she was thinking the same thing. It was a good bet she was also plotting how to help the fighters outside. Hoover still wasn't sure that was the right move for defending Baru, but if the Union forces were hurling asteroids at the planet, he wasn't sure it mattered anymore. Still, any wrong move, even the right move taken too soon, would mean instant death. He shook his head slightly, a signal to Breen to hold tight. The gunfire outside was heavier now. He suspected both sides were engaged in an intense firefight. Despite his determination to remain impartial, to keep his focus on the mission, he found himself rooting for the resistance. He'd seen more than a few firefights, and while experienced, trained troops like Marines or Foudre Rouge were well-drilled in assault tactics, such things tended to bog down between less skilled fighters. He watched Delacorte, saw the animation in her movement, the rage radiating from her body. If he'd had any doubt before that she was insane, it was gone. But still, he stayed where he was, waiting. She might be crazy, but that didn't mean she wasn't capable, even brilliant. And he knew already that she was utterly ruthless. The fighting continued, and he thought the sounds were coming closer. It was hard to be sure, but another glance at Delacorte more or less confirmed it. She didn't look scared. He wasn't sure he'd ever seen her scared. There were occasional advantages to insanity. But she was tense, and her tone became increasingly harsh as she shouted out commands to her soldiers. Hoover was still trying to get a good feel for the status of things outside when the whole building shook. He stumbled, struggling to stay on his feet, as debris fell all around the room from the ceiling. He heard the sounds of parts of the building coming down, and then gunfire, much louder than it had been before. "They're breaking in. Bernard and his people just might pull this off." He felt a burst of satisfaction, but it was tempered by cold analysis. If the resistance fighters got to the control room, he knew what would happen. They'd been victimized, their allies and comrades murdered, their families brutalized by Delacorte's thugs. They would come in, guns blazing, and they wouldn't stop until everyone there was dead. The sudden realization of how poor a chance he had of surviving the counter-revolution distracted him. He'd been on dangerous missions before and escaped a few of those by the slimmest of margins. But now he realized he could be minutes away from his own death. He glanced again toward Breen, wondering if she'd given any thought to how the current fight was likely to end. Even if Bernard's people didn't just shoot everyone indiscriminately, he couldn't imagine the resistance leader would be well disposed to him, or to his people. He turned the man down flat when he'd come looking for help, and he'd given the resistance every reason to categorize him as an ally of the current regime. He put some hope into the notion that the resistance wouldn't want to alienate the Confederation, but he also wondered if Bernard had seen through the true purpose of his mission, the cold reality that he wasn't there to help the people of Brew at all, other than to make them the most effective barbs against a resurgent Union. There was another explosion, and one of the walls blasted open, sending debris flying all around the room. He saw a chunk of metal hit Sylvia Breen, and he raced over as the spy dropped to the floor with a thud. For an instant, he was sure she was dead, but when he got to her side, he could see that she was still breathing. He tried to see if she had any wounds, but all he could find was a gash on the head where the chunk of metal had hit her. He couldn't be sure, but he thought she'd be okay. Unless, of course, they were all shot in the next few minutes. The battle raged around the room, and within a minute, perhaps two, there were dozens of bodies littering the floor. The resistance fighters were suffering the worst, mostly because their weapons were older, less effective. But they seemed to have the numbers, and Hoover was willing to bet they also had the drive of men and women who understood how fleeting their advantage was. Delacorte had no doubt called in reserves from all over the city, and that meant time wasn't an ally to the resistance. Hoover watched as the battle continued, and then suddenly he saw Henri Bernard. The resistance leader was crouched behind a pile of debris. It was partial cover, but a position that had a weak side. And Amy Delacorte was standing on that side, bringing her weapon up to bear. Hoover had spent weeks, months, arguing with Breen, resisting her constant harangues to aid the resistance. But now something took over inside him. Before he even knew what he was doing, he had leapt to his feet and lunged forward. He was stumbling across the room, off balance, right toward Delacorte. She saw him, too late, and she turned to shoot. But he slammed into her first, the two of them dropping together. Bernard reacted, turning toward the spot he'd ignored until an instant before. His arm flashed up, and he fired three times in rapid succession. Hoover gritted his teeth, waited for the pain of impact, but there was none. He hit the ground and brought himself back up in a combat roll, and spun his head around, trying to figure out what had happened. Delacorte was lying on her back, her eyes wide open, transfixed, seeming to stare at the ceiling. But they were blank. A chunk of her skull was missing, and he could see the exposed gray of brain matter covered with a wet sheen of blood. He hesitated just for a second, but by the time he raised his head, he could see two fighters, Delacorte's people, aiming their rifles right at him. He'd survived two close calls, but it didn't look like three was in the cards.
I'm dead. It was the only thought that went through his mind. Then he heard the shots, automatic fire. But there was no pain. Nothing.
He watched in stunned silence as his two would-be killers fell back to the ground, their bodies riddled with half a dozen bullet holes each. He turned, still stunned, and he saw three of Bernard's people standing across the room, their guns still aiming at the spot Delacorte's people had occupied until seconds before. Two of the resistance fighters just stood where they were, but the third looked at him and nodded once, right before he turned and plunged back into the battle.
Chapter 41 CFS Repulse Z-11 System Year 315 AC Sari Eden stood in front of her chair in the center of Repulse's command center. She knew she should be in her seat, her harness securely buckled across her body. But she'd never had an easy time sitting still in battle, and the residual effects of the wounds she suffered in the campaign around Arcturon early in the war had made remaining seated too long downright torturous. She'd been watching Jake Stockton's squadrons launching their bombing runs on the hegemony ships. Stockton had tried to target the enemy battleships, but in at least half a dozen instances, enemy escorts had interposed themselves, taking the brunt of the assault in those spots. The enemy ships were tough, and that was putting it lightly. She watched as hegemony vessels, both escorts and battleships, soaked up enough damage that would have reduced their Confederation counterparts to clouds of superheated gas. But Jake Stockton was a relentless warrior, and his spirit had infected his entire fighter corps. His pilots brought their bombers in one after the other, closing to unheard-of ranges before they launched their weapons. The enemy ships had considerably more thrust than anything in the White Fleet, and their navigation AI seemed to be superior as well. Despite the courage of Stockton's pilots, many of the torpedoes missed, evaded by last-second moves more powerful and better planned than any she'd ever seen before. But the bombing runs had done their jobs nevertheless. At least half of the incoming ships were damaged, and some badly. The plasma torpedoes had claimed four ships outright, but they'd all been cruiser-sized vessels, like those present in the initial battle. None of the enemy battleships had been destroyed, though Eaton had identified two she thought looked close. Both were lagging the main body of the hegemony fleet, and one was leaking atmosphere and fluids badly.
300,000 kilometers to enemy's lead ships, Commodore.
Eaton waved toward the tactical station and nodded.
Acknowledged.
Her mind was too occupied for more than that. She was staring at the display, at the enemy ships moving steadily toward the fleet. They would fire before her ships were in range to respond, that was a certainty. The screen was marked at the distances where the enemy escorts had opened fire, but Eaton's eyes were on the large icons, the massive battleships at the center of the hegemony formation. She was sure those giant ships would outrange the cruisers the fleet had fought before, and that their guns would be stronger, more powerful. But she had no idea whether that would be 280,000 kilometers or 250, or 200. Whatever the distance turned out to be, it would decide the battle. The bombing runs had hurt the enemy, and the White Fleet outnumbered the approaching force. If her ships and the others of the fleet could close before they'd suffered crippling damage, they had a chance. If not, well, that wasn't something she wanted to think about.
We need to move forward now at full thrust. We've got to minimize the time before we can return fire.
The strategy sessions before the fight had been contentious ones. Many of the fleet senior officers had wanted to pull back, to give the bombing squadrons time to return to their mother ships and rearm for a second strike. Others, and she had been the leader of this group, argued that the enemy's superior thrust capacity would allow them to catch the fleet while the fighters were still half refueled in the bays. The extra time it would take the hegemony to close against retreating ships would only lengthen the period during which they could fire, but the fleet ships could not. Cillian Globus had been her ally in the debate, though his reasoning had differed from her analytical and mathematical arguments. Eden would have been all for the plan to pull back slowly if she'd thought it had a chance of working. But to the Palatians, that tactic carried the taint of dishonor. The Alliance officers clamored to push forward and hit the enemy with as much force as possible, a position based on warrior code rather than on any real data. Eden had expected Baron to come down on her side. He had agreed, more or less, but he'd been distracted in a way she'd never seen before, and he'd hesitated to make a final decision and issue the orders. Eden knew the fleet's famous commander was worried about the people on the surface, but she was sure there was something more than that on his mind. She'd considered it for a while, and finally she'd come up with an answer. It was the impending battle and what it portended. Tyler Baron had set out in command of a great exploration fleet, his mission to seek out old technology and improve the Confederation's knowledge of the old empire. He'd no doubt expected dangers, but he couldn't have been ready for what the fleet had found. A new war, one that might be very dangerous and deadly indeed, and it had started on Baron's watch. She understood her friend's hesitancy, his reluctance to order the fleet forward to finish the battle, one way or another. But she also knew there was no choice. Baron had done nothing to provoke the enemy, and if the fighting here spread to a longer and wider war, he would have no fault in any of it. That's easy to say, but would you listen to that if you were in Tyler's place? She wanted to help her friend, but there was nothing to do. And as she watched the enemy's lead ships close to 280,000 kilometers, she knew it didn't matter. The only important thing now was to do whatever gave the fleet the best chance at victory. And that meant moving forward now. She turned toward the comm station. "Get me Dauntless. Commodore, Admiral Baron is on the fleet comm line now. On speaker, Lieutenant." The officer's hands moved over his workstation, and a few seconds later, Tyler Baron's voice was blaring through Repulse's control center speakers. "All ships, all crews, this is Admiral Baron. We came here in peace, as researchers, explorers, and yet we have found a new enemy. It was my desire to seek peaceful relations, but that has proven to be impossible. So if war is inevitable, it is time for us to set aside wishes for peace and to focus on what must be done now. If a war must be fought, our only concern is to win it at all costs. So the order is simple. All ships, maximum thrust. Advance and close on the enemy. Conduct maximum evasive maneuvers, and the instant your weapons are in range, open fire with every watt of power you can throw their way. You're all veterans and you know what to do. Go now, into the fight, and we will win the victory as we have so many times before." Repulse's control center was silent. Once again, Eden was amazed at the effect Tyler Baron could have on his subordinates. Her crew, of course, but even her. She turned toward the nav station. "You heard the orders, Commander. Full thrust. Take us into battle." The bridge erupted into a grim but enthusiastic cheer. Whatever lay ahead, her people were ready. "I want all batteries powered up and ready to fire the instant we enter range." Cillian Globus stood on Fortiter's bridge, snapping out commands to his tactical officer. "The enemy has the edge on speed and maneuverability, but we are Palatians, and the blood of warriors flows through our veins. Targeting will be key here. Use your experience, your skill, your intuition. But hit those bastards, and hit them hard." Fortiter shook as another one of the enemy's beams struck the ship. Globus was playing the role his people needed him to play, acting as though none of the enemy's actions worried him. But the range differential between his ships and the hegemony vessels was a huge problem, and he knew it. His ships were all damaged already, and not a single one had yet fired a shot. The situation was even worse on his force than on the Confeds, whose primaries also outranged the weaponry of Fortiter and his other ships. The technology behind the enemy beam still hadn't been fully explained, despite the best efforts of the fleet scientists and engineering teams. Even the legendary Anya Fritz, whose reputation had reached as far as the Alliance, had come up blank so far. But there had been a terrible revelation in this battle. Those deadly energy weapons were something akin to secondary batteries, and their battleships packed an even greater punch, one that had been absent from the cruisers the fleet had faced earlier. Globus had seen the effects of the enemy's devastating primary weapons. They weren't the mystery the beams were, at least not superficially. The Confederation had developed its own railgun systems, and even the perennially behind-the-curve Alliance had produced some models. But none of the Rim powers had managed to achieve the acceleration rates necessary to weaponize the devices over the ranges at play in space combat. At a range of 100,000 kilometers, a ship had less than a third of a second to react to a laser or other weapon traveling at light speed. Even the fastest railgun-launched projectiles on the Rim moved at only 15,000 kilometers per second. That would take a full 10 seconds to reach the target, and give a nav AI time for a quick nap before launching evasive maneuvers. The hegemony weapon solved that problem in a very straightforward way, if one that reached far beyond current Confederation technology levels. Somehow, the weapon accelerated the projectiles to nearly 25% of light speed, cutting the reaction time at 100,000 kilometers to more like a second and a quarter. They didn't quite match light-based weaponry in accuracy, but they came close enough to make evasion far from a sure thing. Globus had watched in horror as the Confederation battleship Indefatigable took the first hit from one of the weapons. The shot had been an imperfect one, more of a glancing blow than a direct hit. But as the reports flowed in, Globus realized the ship had been virtually crippled. A huge section of the vessel's aft had been torn away, or simply vaporized. The Palatian was a warrior and not a scientist, but he had some idea of the kinetic energy a projectile traveling at near-relativistic speeds imparted to its target, and he shuddered to imagine what a direct hit would do to Fortiter, or any of the fleet's capital ships. There appeared to be one saving grace. The rate of fire of the weapon appeared to be very slow, and only the largest hegemony ship seemed to mount it. That didn't help a ship unfortunate enough to take one of the deadly hits, but it did give the fleet as a whole a chance. The support system supplying that kind of power had to be fragile, which meant the more the fleet could pound away at those hegemony battleships, the likelier they were to take the railguns out of the equation. 1 minute to firing range, Commander. Globus turned and gestured his acknowledgement. His bridge officers had all seen the effects of the enemy railguns, and they all knew that one could fire on the Alliance flagship at any moment. But they were calm, focused, keeping their fears deep inside. They were Palatian warriors, and Globus expected, and would tolerate nothing less from them. But that didn't stop him from feeling pride. A Palatian's life was a hard one in many ways, and duty and honor stood above all other considerations. It was how he had lived his life, and how his children would, and their children. Zillian Globus was unable to imagine an alliance that deviated from its ideals. The way is the way. He could see on the display that the Confederation battleships had already opened fire, at least the ones that still had operational primary batteries. That was about half of them, he noted as his eyes moved across the screen. Zillian had seen those batteries slicing into Red Alliance ships during the Civil War, and he'd watched as the weapons utterly obliterated Palatia's vaunted orbital defenses. But they were fragile, the immense systems of energy transmission that powered them highly subject to breakdown. Significant progress had been made in toughening up the systems, but some of the fragility still remained. The Confederation fire was beginning to have an effect, but the enemy ships were so maneuverable they reduced the hit rate far below normal. The targeting against the hegemony vessels was falling short, a third, and perhaps less of the hit rates he'd seen against the Union fleet at the bottleneck. Still, when those particle accelerator beams hit, even the advanced and high-tech hegemony vessels took damage, and those ships had already been savaged by Jake Stockton's bombing attacks. Globus knew the squadrons, including the ones from his own ships, were the only thing giving the fleet a chance. They'd done their part, and now it was up to the battleships like Fortiter to finish the job. He watched the display as the distance to the lead enemy ships dropped steadily, his hands closing slowly into fists as the number slipped below his battery's maximum range. He turned toward the tactical station, staring across the bridge for a few seconds. Then he said simply, "All ships, open fire." "I want everybody landed in 15 minutes. I don't care what it takes or what the bay crews have to do." Stockton was nearly shouting, more a reflection of the adrenaline flowing through him than any real anger. "And tell Chief Evans and the other crew chiefs in the fleet, they're not only going to turn these ships around in record time, they're going to convert the interceptors to bombing kits." "We're doing the best we can, Jake, but the evasive maneuvers are interfering with landing operations. It's going to be more than 15 minutes, I can tell you that much. You'd better plan on getting partial forces back out because you're never going to get all your birds back aboard in time." Stockton felt his face heat up, a flush of anger. The voice on his comm was Stars, and his rage wasn't targeted at her, just at the hard lesson in reality she was giving him. But he couldn't hold it back. "You tell those idiots in the bays that my ships are coming in, and we're coming in fast, and every damned battleship in this fleet better be ready for that." His tone was raw, angry, and he immediately regretted unleashing it on her. But he could see the raging fight the fleet was in, and he knew the battle was a desperate one. Even with Baron's leadership and whatever tricks or tactical wizardry the Admiral might try, his gut told him they were going to lose, unless he could get another fighter strike out. He shook his head. That need he felt. It didn't change reality. The fleet's battleships were executing wild nav programs to evade the fire from the hegemony ships. That was good tactics and the only way the fleet had a chance to survive the enemy's incoming fire. But it played havoc with landing fighters. His pilots had to approach motherships that were changing their velocities and vectors every few seconds, and at times in intervals of even less than a second. The only way to land was to connect with the ship's main nav control and to sync up with the evasive programs. But that was a damn difficult thing for a fighter pilot to do. Stockton knew he'd lose people trying to get his birds back into their bays, but there was no choice. His fighters were the only advantage the fleet had.
All right, listen up.
He was on the command channel, speaking to his squadron commanders and above. We're gonna have to land while our motherships are bouncing around like crazy, trying to avoid that incoming fire. That means one hell of a tricky landing. Wing commanders, line up your squadrons, one after the other. I want the most experienced ones landing first. That way we get them back out the fastest and...
He hesitated just for an instant. That way we're bringing in the pilots most likely to land. We can't risk leaving our best squadron stuck out here if somebody loses it on landing and trashes a bay.
Which will almost certainly happen. Let's go. Get it done. Stockton didn't particularly like his cold-blooded approach, but he knew what he had to do, and there was no sense thinking about it any further.
Ship's already equipped his bombers first. We're going to be able to launch those without escorts, and I want maximum turnaround.
He really wanted to send his entire strike force back in one combined attack, but that just wasn't possible. The fleet needed whatever attack power he could get out there, as quickly as possible. Besides, waiting would only mean more bays knocked out of action and fighters destroyed, as their motherships took damage in the fight.
"Dauntless Wing," he said after he flipped the comm back to the channel for the flagship's group. "We're going in one squadron at a time. Blues first, then Scarlet Eagles, Reds, Yellows, and then Greens."
He'd violated his own rule about bomber-fitted squadrons landing first. The Blues were the best he had, and he wanted them back out first.
"I want everybody sharp as a razor here. Dauntless is jerking all over the place with evasive maneuvers, and you need to link your AIs with the main navcom and match those shifts."
A short pause. "I'm going in first, and the rest of you follow." Stockton had intended to stay where he was, but the landing was so dangerous he decided to go first, to lead the way. Because he'd flown around without a weapon during the first strike, and he was determined to draw some blood with a second. He angled his throttle, his other hand flipping switches to link his own system with Dauntless's navcom. A small blue light flicked on, confirming the link. He could feel the fighter shifting on its own as his onboard AI took over, matching moves Dauntless's main system transmitted. Stockton always hated allowing a computer to fly his ship, and now was no different. But he knew there was no choice. Only the AI could read and execute the exact vectors and thrust strengths and angles coming in from Dauntless's navcom. The problem was the delay caused by transmission and execution of the maneuver, which put the fighter and the landing platform slightly out of sync. In the end, the pilot's feel, his intuition, was what made the combat landing work, and Stockton was the best. He glided his ship toward Dauntless, feeling the fighter jerk hard as the AI swung it around and blasted thrust in different directions. The fighter was coming in for a landing, and that meant it couldn't just match the big vessel's move. It had to maintain its approach vector, line up with the opening to the landing bay. Dauntless shook hard as yet another enemy beam slammed into its side. Stockton was close enough now for visual contact, and he could see the gash in the ship's white metal exterior. Explosions blasted up from inside. Stockton had a career of experience in assessing the severity of hits, and he could see that last one had been bad. Not critical, perhaps, but it had almost certainly knocked out some systems. And killed some crew. Comrades of his. Friends. He gripped the throttle as his ship moved toward the battleship, ready to adjust the AI's course. Dauntless was gyrating now, spinning around and firing thrusters as she lurched back to bring her guns to bear on the enemy. The dance was a complex one, almost impossible for a human mind to follow, but it was one the ship's AI executed well. As Stockton's scanners confirmed by displaying two more enemy beams, both of them missing Dauntless by a few hundred meters. He could see the bay opening coming up, on his screen and also through the cockpit. Relative to Dauntless's course and velocity, he was approaching slowly. His ship seemed to crawl forward as it blasted its engines to restore alignment. Dauntless's evasive maneuvers were heavier than any he'd seen before. He understood. The enemy's targeting was just too good, and Admiral Baron was doing everything possible to protect his ships. But it made landing fighters that much harder. Stockton had known he'd lose pilots in the combat landing operation, but he could feel that number rising now. He'd ordered all his people to come in at minimal velocity. He didn't want some pilot losing it and smashing into a bay at high speed. That would just be a gift to the enemy. But even at a crawl, a fighter missing the opening and hitting the hull was going to be a real problem, especially for the pilot of that ship. Stockton's hand tightened around the controls, and he shifted his arm slightly, keeping his course aligned with the bay opening. He could feel the sweat running down his back, and